Facebook is pushing back against the Biden administration after the president accused the social media company of killing people by facilitating the spread of disinformation about the coronavirus vaccine. Biden made that comment last week after his surgeon general called pandemic misinformation an urgent threat to public health and said tech companies need to do more to stop it. Facebook, which we should mention is a financial supporter of NPR, has deleted some posts with false vaccine claims and removed certain accounts that have repeatedly broken rules against vaccine disinformation. But this is just the latest in a series of public disputes over how Facebook polices its platform. The ongoing saga is the subject of a new book out this month exploring the inner workings of the company and its top executives. It's called An Ugly Truth: Inside Facebook's Battle for Domination, and its authors join me now. Shira Frankel and Cecilia Kang, welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
So I understand the word ugly in your title comes from one of Facebook's own vice presidents, Andrew Bosworth, and you chronicle several ugly things about the social network. But I'd say the central truth that comes through in your reporting is that many of Facebook's flaws are actually not bugs. They're deliberate design choices. How did you come to that conclusion, Shira?
Yeah, it's so true. We're not looking at bugs here. We're looking at features. So many of Facebook's problems are built into the way that they do business. The fact that they've built a company that in order to succeed, they have to get you engaged as much as possible and spending as much time on their platform as they possibly can. That's how they get data about you, and that's how they sell ads. And so the very business model that they're premised on, and let's be clear, this is a very successful business model. This is a trillion-dollar company, is to keep you online. And a lot of what our book chronicles is the downwind effects of all that.
It's funny, too, Cecilia, because, of course, for a long time, Facebook was not profitable, but they were trying to scale up, like so many venture-backed companies are, right? So is this a case of a company that lost its way, or was this kind of the plan from the get-go, you think?
Well, this was a company that had growth as its most important goal. What Mark Zuckerberg, the co-founder, did was he brought a very important person to grow the company and the business model. And her name, as we all know, is Sheryl Sandberg, the chief operating officer. And what we do in this book is we try to bring readers up very close to their relationship in this very powerful business partnership where the technology visionary and a business visionary were brought together to create this company that we're talking about with 3 billion users around the world, unprecedented and historical in its reach.
And one of the things that seems really striking, I think, is that the corporate leadership consistently comes through as off guard or flat-footed when something significant comes up. For example, they seem to not have a plan for how to deal with then-presidential candidate Donald Trump, who was making, I guess what you'd call innovative use of the algorithms of the news feed to dominate attention on the platform. And I guess I'm wondering if that surprised you, because while many people didn't see Donald Trump per se coming, wouldn't it have been possible to imagine that there would be some political figure in the not-too-distant future who would come along and might do exactly what he did?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're pointing to something really important, and it did surprise us. Many things surprise us in this process. Most chiefly is that they weren't looking at warning signs that were being delivered to them, straight to them, the top executives, by executives within the company. Donald Trump only surfaced a lot of the core problems that had been baked into the technology and the business model.
And one thing I want to add to what Cecilia said is that it isn't just about Trump. I mean, we hope people read this book because they're interested in how Facebook really helped make Trump what he is. But, you know, Facebook is still around. There are lots of countries all over the world that are holding elections. And there's only going to continue to be other leaders who take advantage of Facebook's ability to make things go viral. And I think until we really contend with that as a society, as a world, we're not going to understand how social media has changed all of our lives.
You know, one of the other flaws that you describe in the book is this very open access that all Facebook engineers, some 16,000 plus at the time, had access to sort of the back-end profiles of users. This is more information about users than would be publicly available on their profiles. And some of these employees were abusing that power. It was often men using it to, frankly, digitally stalk women they were interested in. Mark Zuckerberg, in your recounting, was dismayed that that was the case. But this was, as you write, part of the design of Facebook from the beginning, that this was this open access that engineers had was designed to allow them to be nimble, to iterate, to innovate very, very quickly. So I'm wondering if this is a case of the ugly truth that you're identifying as the central premise. Was this not a design flaw, but actually a trade-off that Facebook was willing to make?
Absolutely. And, you know, for us, discovering that was, I think, one of the most frightening moments for us as reporters. 52 people were fired as a result of abusing their access to people's data. And I want to make it clear, this isn't data that you or I would see if we went on Facebook right now. This is intimate details of people's lives, what restaurant they're eating at in that moment, where they're traveling in real time, even predictive things that Facebook can tell about you based on patterns in your usage, what you're likely to do in the future. Now imagine having access, being able to tap into that, you know, at any point in time. In many cases, these were engineers that were using this to stalk women that they were interested in. I thought, you know, Mark Zuckerberg certainly was appalled when he discovered how many people it had been. But if I had gotten a chance to interview him, one question I would have had is, why didn't you figure it out earlier? Men were getting fired all the time for doing this. Couldn't you have put that pattern together yourself and seen that this was a problem, given that it was Mark Zuckerberg that instituted this policy of transparency and giving these engineers access to everything?
So have you then seen a significant shift in Zuckerberg's approach since then and since other big scandals have come to light? For example, you know, election meddling in the 2016 election was a big one. It seemed to me that you took either Zuckerberg or people around him at their word that he genuinely seemed to think that truth and good speech on his platform would ultimately drown out the bad stuff. I'm thinking, for example, of the libertarian approach he took to Holocaust deniers and allowing that to continue for a while. He seemed surprised that it spread, particularly among millennials, that this was something that was gaining traction. So just so I'm clear, do you take him at his word on that? Do you think that that surprise is sincere and that the effort to combat it is also?
You know, what we've learned about Mark Zuckerberg is that those ideas around free speech and a libertarian approach were really embedded in him in his very earliest days of founding Facebook. He's in his early 20s. He comes out to Silicon Valley. And some of his founders, the original founders, were people who espoused these ideals. These are men that continue to mentor him until today. And so if that's the formation of your ideology, is that these free speech ideas, these libertarian approaches are not just good for your, you know, good for the way you think, really, you know, adhere to your current line of thinking, but also, let's be honest, very good for business. It's easy to see how you can adopt and strengthen those ideas over time. The people we spoke to who are close to him say that he's genuine about those ideas. The speech that he gave in Georgetown around free speech really came from him. He really believed it and doubled down in it. And as you gave the example, the Holocaust denial on Facebook, he very strongly believed in allowing people to continue to deny the Holocaust on Facebook because it showed how absolute his ideals were in his adherence to free speech. And as you noted, it's only several years later when he's shown data that actually, you know, Holocaust denialism is growing, and even among millennials it's growing, that he finally kind of gets it, that it's not that the best speech is winning out or even the truest speech is winning out, but that the platform, the machine he made, is actually making the most emotive and sometimes the worst and conspiratorial speech win out.
So looking ahead now, I mean, it's hard to remember the origin of Facebook some 17 years ago now. But of course, it was coming in at a time when a lot of people were still using, you know, AOL Instant Messenger and, you know, other social services that have fallen by the wayside since then, or at least had their influence diminished. What do you foresee for Facebook in the next 17 years? Will it still be around? Will it still be the behemoth that it is today?
I think Facebook or tools like Facebook are just not going away. In many countries, Facebook is the internet. That's how they get on the internet. So Facebook's future may absolutely not look like the kind of experience we have today, which is clicking on an app and seeing this blue app open up and start sharing photos with each other. New technologies may take over, but what probably will not go away is the desire to connect people around the world and seeing that there is a business in doing that. And I think it'll be really hard to see the business model of behavioral advertising going away because it is so incredibly successful. So many companies are copying Facebook right now. Facebook made $85 billion last year. It's valued at $1 trillion. There's no blaming other companies for wanting to emulate the company's business model and success.
And, you know, one reason we want people to read our book is because these problems are just not going away. Social media is here. It's going to be around for the rest of our lives. And until you understand why these companies have to define themselves as something other than a neutral platform, maybe they're not a media company, but they certainly don't seem to be neutral platforms anymore. And until we begin to really figure out what our definition is, we're not going to be able to confront the problems that they've introduced.
Shira Frenkel and Cecilia Kang are reporters for The New York Times and authors of the new book, An Ugly Truth, Inside Facebook's Battle for Domination. Shira, Cecilia, thank you.
Thanks so much.
And you can read an excerpt of the book at hereandnow.org.